Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Right, welcome it is. Welcome to the second SPGN Journal Club of 2026 with your hero and mine, Dr. Jake Mann. Jake has responded to the passionate and vociferous outcry of our listeners saying, you never talk about luminal gastroenterology. We acknowledge this. We accept the rebuke. We own our shame. And for that reason, Jake has chosen for today's session two studies in eosinophilic esophagitis. One describes an interesting rise in instances of diagnosed EO. I like the way that that sounds. Sounds almost like the donkey's call, doesn't it? EO. In two regions of Spain. The other provides data suggesting that to assess EO by both histopathologic and molecular biologic criteria as bipartite, that is, with two distinct and perhaps separable components, inflammation and remodeling may be of prognostic value. So what might public health officials do to address this purported rise in the incidence of Spanish EO? That's what the authors of this article want to ask us, and I think it'll be interesting to see what their answers are. And will histopathologic studies of eosinophilic esophagitis acquire new life? Well, as a histopathologist, I certainly hope so. But it's spring, and anything can happen. Jake, our first article is by Arias et al. Prevalence of eosinophilic esophagitis doubles in less than a decade. A population-based study in two regions of Spain that appeared in Journal of Investigative Allergology and Clinical Immunology in March of this year. The two areas are Tomelloso, which is south of Madrid, and in Castilla-La Mancha, 100,000 people there, and in Cáceres, west of Madrid, snuggled up the Portuguese border in Extremadura, 190,000. Those are the populations. The study involved cases from 2006 through 2024, and studied adults and children in Tomelloso, but adults only in Cáceres. There were 193 adults and 50 children studied in Tomelloso and 283 adults in Cáceres. Diagnosis was histopathologic. It required infiltration of the esophageal epithelium by more than 15 eosinophil leukocytes per high-powered field, and the absence of eosinophilic infiltration in biopsy specimens from the gastric and duodenal mucosa, that is, esophagus-specific, and exclusion of other etiologies. In Tomelloso, further to the west, pediatric incidence rates per 100,000 inhabitants rose from 5.43 new cases in 2008 to 38.48, or call it 39, new cases in 2023. Adult incidence rates per 100,000 increased from 3.44 new cases in 2006 to 20.77 new cases per 100,000 in 2017, with stabilization thereafter. The rate of rise flattened. In Cáceres, with only adults, incidence rates per 100,000 also increased from 2.97 new cases in 2007 to 15.82 new cases in 2024. So, what's changed? Jake, what's your take on what might have changed?
Well, I think it's interesting, or any of these sort of prevalent studies, to really think about the other factors that could influence the prevalence as well as a true rise in the incidence of the disorder. Of course, and I guess that's one of the reasons why I wanted to pick it, because there's so many factors that can influence the prevalence of a condition when you're looking at the number of new diagnoses made in a relatively defined region. And the headline of a doubling in less than a decade is quite attention-grabbing, but equally seems to be an astronomically rapid rise in a non-infectious, non-contagious disorder, as far as we currently understand it, at least.
So my thought, looking at this, was, hey, did people buy more endoscopes?
Exactly. I mean, unless I missed it, did they report the number of total scopes they did?
No, they didn't normalize. They didn't normalize the incidence against the number of endoscopic procedures. Now, it's well known that if you go through the wards without a thermometer, your incidence of fever is going to be very low.
Exactly. And that was my kind of first thought when we've read this, that eosinophilic esophagitis has become more known as an important condition, which is manageable and has effective therapy and can deal with difficult symptoms. And the cases that they describe to me seem appropriately diagnosed with the kind of symptomatology that you would expect. And I just wonder whether there's been increased awareness in their comparatively small catchment zones, and that has led to either increased referral rates, or they've had better availability, or perhaps they've hired someone with an expertise in or an interest in eosinophilic esophagitis, and now they're making more diagnoses.
But for us to hypothesize that, Jake, we also have to hypothesize that there are lots of Spaniards wandering about complaining that they can't swallow. Always
yes.
Have been.
So you're right. So it would the next step on from that would be that this isn't an artificial increase in the prevalence rate. It's nearing the true prevalence rate. And at some point, it will plateau. And it's not that the cases have, or the incidence has leveled off. It's that we're reaching the accurate value.
Whoa. So aside from a slap to the wrist of the reviewers who didn't request this attention to detail that we seem to have independently come up with, what else do you make of the article?
One of the other things that stood out to me, which I think is interesting, is figure 1A, where they describe the incidence in children over time, has at first kind of eyeball appearance, a sawtooth appearance to the overall incidence, where it oscillates year on year effectively, or maybe one every 2 years, or one every 3 years perhaps, by a 2 to 3-fold rate at some periods. And that is quite a consistent pattern over a 12 to 13 year period. And I just can't come up with an explanation for it.
I did not pay attention to that particular figure in so much detail as you have done. But this is a seasonal pattern?
Well, they seem to be annualized rates. I guess I wondered, is it that more children referred in 1 year and therefore diagnosed in that year and then they're not diagnosed the next year? Or is this truly a factor of some underlying biology that certain years when there's different climate conditions or related to other allergic responses, sort of hay fever type things come to mind? I mean, I'm completely coming up with probably rubbish ideas, and people who know the field well would think I'm talking gibberish here. But it's just out of all the data, that's the one that kind of stands out to me. Whereas when you look at the incidence in adults, it kind of bumbles along in a relatively flat line, perhaps going up a little bit. It's the incidence in children that's this big sawtooth appearance, and it's just interesting.
Surge and retreat, surge and retreat, by year and not by season of the year. Well, that is something for public health authorities to keep their eyes on. But the authors also suggest that these data may make a difference in allocation of resources to endoscopy suites, which, Jake, we might come back here in 15 years if the Lord spares us both to find out that the incidence has gone up yet again.
Sure. I mean, I spend a disproportionate or an unhealthy amount of time thinking about allocation of resources across healthcare, and whilst I obviously think that hepatology should have more allocation of resources, you speak to a gastroenterologist and they'll think that EOE needs more allocation of resources. They clearly have demonstrated an increase in prevalence, but does that mean that more endoscopies in this population is the best use of public funding?
Jake, if more endoscopies mean more biopsies, then I'm all for more endoscopies.
Exactly. We've all got to fight our own corners. And, you know, these patients have substantial symptoms and can lead to long-term morbidity, and there is an effective treatment. So, for sure. The next step that would be needed, though, is to demonstrate that the limitation of their number of endoscopies is preventing diagnoses, which is preventing treatment, which is resulting in harm, and that total cost and burden of harm is greater than could be spared by use of resources and or money on another condition, which could be completely unrelated.
Such as the liver.
Such as the liver, or even other organs.
Bite your tongue.
Sorry.
Okay.
We'll stick to the liver.
Stick to the liver then, and now move on to the second article by Indor Ababalil and from Shamir Medical Center, which is an enormous general hospital, 800 beds, a bit south of Tel Aviv in western Israel. For 22 months, patients aged between 6 and 65 in whom endoscopy was conducted for suspected eosinophilic esophagitis, 86 in all, with an age range of between 6 and 46, as it happened, and 69 of them being under 18 years old. The diagnosis was histopathologic eosinophilia with eosinophilia and basal layer epithelial hyperplasia, which is almost as good as EO because it comes out as bleh, were scored separately. 26 of 86 suspected patients actually had EO. 53 had something else, and 7 had we didn't know what. 6 EO patients had no bleh, and I'm taking it as read that the other 20 did. Wide-net analyses of plasma samples found high concentrations of something that you might expect, an eosinophil leukocyte chemotactic factor, CCL26 when it's at home, as associated with EO. And high values for CCL26 were also associated with bleh. Follow-up endoscopy after 3 months of proton pump inhibitor therapy found resolution of eosinophilia without resolution of bleh in 80% of those studies. And I'm not clear on whether or not plasma was sampled at follow-up with similar molecular analyses. What the authors conclude from this is that whatever EO is, at least one component of it, that is bleh, doesn't go away. What should we do about that? Should there be continued therapy? Should there be continued monitoring? Jake, over to you.
I mean, this is, if I'm being completely honest, this is the first time I've ever read about basal cell hyperplasia and really understood it. I'm sure that at some stage I looked down a microscope with our expert pathologist and she told me all about it. But I had never it is not one of the things that keeps me awake at night thinking about the significance of basal cell hyperplasia in persistent and or previously treated EoE.
Jake, we give you full marks for honesty. Confession is good for the soul, but how can you say, oh my God.
I was also thinking of you. This is another paper that discusses histology as a core kind of starting point without any pictures of histology in the paper.
Histopathology is and always has been the eosinophil-headed stepchild.
One of the reasons, though, I did pick this is that it discusses Olink proteomics, which is a rapidly expanding a technique that's in rapidly expanding use, and it is a pretty cool technique where you can send them some plasma samples or serum samples, and then they use this technique called proximity extension assay, which is having two antibodies, which they report as being highly specific to each protein, so two per protein. And each of those antibodies is already bound to a DNA strand. And then when the two antibodies bind to the protein, you then have the two complementary parts of DNA form a double chain. And then that is then used to basically make a DNA library. And therefore, you'll have increased abundance of DNA where you have increased abundance of that protein with a specific DNA barcode per protein. And then you use DNA sequencing to effectively get back to the amount of protein that was in the sample. And
the DNA barcode is not the DNA that encodes the particular protein of interest. It's simply a reference tag.
Exactly. It's just a reference tag. It's a way that then they can calculate the number of that initial type of protein in the sample.
Okay.
And it's very effective, high throughput. Here they've done a 384 panel, but it goes up to, I think, a 5,000 panel as well. And it's relatively accessible, needing only a small amount of sample compared to other techniques. You don't need to be an expert to do it. They will just send you back data on your proteins in the sample of interest.
So they brought out the big guns, and what did they shoot?
Well, that's the challenge. The more things you test, the smaller your p-values have to be in order to be significant. And effectively, the only thing that they found was CCL26 is upregulated in EoE, and that is well established, and it is a main chemotactic factor for eosinophils, which has been demonstrated lots of times before. It is nice that they replicated that. However, it is the only finding.
Aside from, and which I point out that you are taking care to overlook, the value of bleh, the value of assessing bleh, the need to assess bleh, the prognostic implications of bleh. What are the prognostic implications of bleh? They rather leave that hanging, don't they?
They do. And I guess I read it more as this was a serum proteomic analysis and they were hoping to identify differences based on whether they were pure EoE or whether they had resolving or persistent changes, and they basically didn't, probably because of power. They simply would need three times as many samples, individual patients, to then demonstrate differences. So, I mean, if I'm being completely honest, I think they found effectively nothing in this paper. Not that they've done anything that wrong, but all this chat about ITGA11 and this TNF receptor and the collagen 9, it's nice, but like, it's completely speculative. You can't then just pick out in a single cohort a non-significant p-value and then say, well, it was less than 0.05 if you don't correct for multiple testing. And we've done it in a single cohort. So again, I am kind of surprised that the reviewers let the paper had put quite so much emphasis on these non-significant genes.
The work that was done did, however, and as you point out, interestingly did, validate the use of this technique, although one could wish that it had been applied to a larger number of samples. Maybe the author's suggestion that BLEH be considered independently of eosinophil infiltration as a marker of ongoing injury, unresolved injury, in this condition has some value. Would you like to try to shoot that down?
I think that that's a very good point, which, again, as a complete non-expert in this field, sounds like something that should be really mapped out. The data points that I would want to see are demonstrating that if you have ongoing basal cell hyperplasia despite resolution of the eosinophilia, does that lead to ongoing symptoms, which is usually one of your key markers of when to decide about treatment or ongoing or stepping up and stepping down? And even if, let's say, you had resolution of symptoms but ongoing this other histological changes, then long-term, does that lead to increased morbidity, for example, stricturing or something else horrible like that, which has kind of continues in the background silently? And that would be key, because you need to make a decision about, are you going to continue treatment or step up to the next tier of treatment, when typically if the eosinophilia and the symptoms have gone, then you would step down or at least hold steady.
Jake, thank you very much. This has been, for me at least, who has spent most of his professional life in the fields of the Lord, that is to say, in the liver, this has been an interesting excursion with gun and camera through the esophagus. But we have to depart. Selma, our producer, is wig-wagging at us to say, you've used up your time. Not all of our time, Selma, because we have to remind our listeners, June, Lille, book your flights, book your rooms, book your attendance. The ESPGAN annual meeting is coming up. If you want to see the face made for podcasting, face made for radio is what they used to call it, all of us will be there in a little room hidden well away, but come by and say hello.
See you in Lille, Alex.